Hey y'all, Max here. If you're enjoying the Bitchy of History, it would mean a lot to Allison and myself if you would give us a rating, or even better, a comment on iTunes. Those ratings and comments help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thank you so much.
The Bitchy of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
Start your free trial today and download a free audiobook by visiting audibletrial.com/bitchery. Hello.
Welcome back to
The Bitchery of History.
I'm Allison.
And my name's Max.
Today I am going to be talking to you about the warrior queen Boudica.
So excited.
Get excited.
And I'm going to be talking about Mary Ellen Pleasant, the mother of civil rights in California.
Woo. All right. I don't know anything about her, so inform me.
I didn't either until I watched an episode of Drunk History about her.
Oh.
Love Drunk History. If any of you are not familiar with it, it started off as a YouTube series, got picked up by Comedy Central, and is now a show that comes out. So Mary Ellen Pleasant, going into the story, it's important for me to note that there's not much known about Mary Ellen Pleasant because she was very secretive about her life. Because at this time she was living during the 1800s in America, and it was right during the time that in her lifetime we saw the end of slavery. We saw the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Gold Rush. And so she's born as a slave, possibly. She's born in the South somewhere, but she's a bonded worker. Or she's born outside of the country. She finds herself in the South and makes her way to San Francisco. You find while researching her that there's many different stories about how she got to the main points that everyone agrees on. So what's known is that she is born in 1814, somewhere around my birthday, which is August 20th. Keep it in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And she finds her way to San Francisco during the time of the Great California Gold Rush. And at this time, San Francisco is only 15% women.
Whoa.
It's a huge disparity there. And she steps off the boat. And it said that right away she found her first business opportunity. Because in San Francisco, which was 85% men, apparently none of them knew how to care for themselves. So they all lived in these bachelor apartment draft houses where many of them would be living in cots, like on all of these different rooms, instead of living in apartments or houses with families.
Mm.
So she starts these houses for the men of San Francisco, but she starts them classy. Starts having balls. She starts putting on society functions. There's one point when the governor of California is living there and actually has his swearing-in ceremony in her house.
Whoa.
Yeah, so like this is where all of the government officials who were living in these draft houses, they lived in hers. And so she started the one, and then she started another, and then she started more and more and more. And then she falls in love with this man named Thomas Bell, and they become partners in business and in life. And it should be noted, she's fair enough that she passes as white. And it even says in the census records that she lists herself not only as white, but she lists herself as a capitalist by profession as her job. And so her and Thomas Bell end up, through all of their business ventures, amassing a fortune worth, at that time, about $30 million.
Oh my goodness.
Which in today's money, according to the IRS website, would be worth about $700 million.
Oh goodness.
$700 million. And so this is where she begins to have a double life. Once she really establishes herself as this multimillionaire capitalist, literally one of the richest people in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
if not the United States, she starts actively funding Underground Railroad expansions.
Ooh.
She starts funding slave revolts. She funds this one abolitionist. His name is John Brown. They get together and form this plan to buy land up in Canada that they can set up as a refuge for escaping slaves.
Oh, wow.
And so she gives him a note professing her devotion to his cause and her devotion to him as support. And when he gets caught and hanged, they find the note on his body.
Right.
And it's signed M-E-P, but apparently they thought it said W-E-P. So when they printed it in all the papers and when they started circulating it saying, we're looking for this, you know, abolitionist funder, they were saying, look out for W-E-P instead of M-E-P.
Nice.
There are some who say that wasn't an accident. She signed it so that it would look like W-E-P because she knew what she was doing. Along with all of this work that she was doing nationally to help the civil rights movement, she starts doing stuff locally as well. In San Francisco, as part of this double life, all of the high-class establishment people know her as a white woman, but the entire black community knows her as a black woman. And she starts hiring in all of these different houses people of color into positions that they had never been hired into before. Mm. Waiters, busboys, bellhops, everything. She also earns the nickname the Black City Hall because almost invariably whenever there would be a problem that an African-American person might have, they would bring it to her. She would use her connections to figure out how to get it done, and she would almost always get that person what they needed or what they wanted.
Wow.
So she really was one of the most influential voices in San Francisco, in California as a whole at the time. I mean, the governor, for Christ's sakes, was living right in her place. Now, of course, abolition comes and slavery ends. And the census directly after the ending of slavery in 1890, she thinks or she feels that it's safe now for her to identify herself officially as a black woman. And this is kind of where things start going downhill for her. Because as soon as the establishment figured out that she was a black woman, she didn't really lose much influence while her husband was still alive because he was a white man. Rumors started circulating. The most vicious of which, and the one that kind of stuck the hardest, was that she was a voodoo queen. There were people who came forward speaking as former employees. I mean, there was one story where this maid said that she walked in on Mary Ellen Pleasant, pulling apart the bones in the skull of someone she recognized as one of the bellboys or something like that.
How do you recognize a skull?
I don't know. But I mean, that's the kind of thing where it's because she was a slave and because she was so phenomenally successful in her business enterprises, a lot of people...
He had to explain it some way.
Exactly. It even went so far that the San Francisco Chronicle itself, the newspaper, was spreading the rumors. They said that she stole white people's money. They spread rumors that she was a madam, that her houses were houses of prostitution. Mm-hmm. They even said that she stole babies and sold them on the black market. Oh, and she was also accused of putting a spell on a senator, like a love potion on a senator to make him do things for her.
Ugh.
All of these rumors really start affecting and diminishing her status in San Francisco once her husband passes away. Almost immediately upon his death, they start openly and overtly criticizing her. They start calling her Mistress Mamie, which at the time was what racist, stereotypically the big, happy black woman slave was named.
Mm-hmm.
And she is very vociferously, I mean, there are many accounts of her not being happy with it. And unfortunately, kind of put the nail in the coffin for Mary Ellen Pleasant in terms of her status and in terms of the kind of things that she could get done. And so she passed away January 4th, 1904. She is known to this day as the mother of civil rights in California because of not only all the work that she did, but she was also instrumental in a couple court cases where she was refused service on a trolley. Because of that, she is responsible for the desegregation of the trolleys in San Francisco. The legal desegregation of the trolleys.
Wow.
In San Francisco.
Very
yeah,
cool.
So big moment. Very big moment for her.
Yeah.
We're not really sure how she died. Again, it's one of those things that even to this day, her and everyone around her kind of had a different story for how she passed away.
Right.
So we're not really sure.
1904, and she was born in the early 1800s. She was 90,
yeah.
So she could have just...
She could have just passed away.
Passed away, mm-hmm. You know.
Sure.
In her sleep.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah.
I've never heard of her.
An
Thanks
amazing
for
woman.
Finding
yeah.
that and sharing.
Yeah.
So I am doing a Queen Boudica, Warrior Queen Boudica, which was actually recommended to me by someone, and they didn't really remember the story. They just said, you should look up this Celtic queen who led an army and something, something. So I looked it up, and I am in love. Charlize Theron needs to play this role in the next movie. Or the next movie. In the movie. First thing to say is that everything that we know about her is written from the point of view of the Romans, from two Roman historians. Sure. Any documentation that was in Britain at the time or written by the Celts or any of the native people in Britain.
First-hand documentation.
And, right. Has been destroyed. It's gone.
Okay.
Or there just wasn't any. They didn't write anything down.
Sure.
So she was born around AD 25.
AD
25? AD 25.
Okay.
In Celtic Britain to a royal family. She married Prosodicus, who was king of the Iceni tribe, and Prosodicus had made a deal with Rome to be a client king, so the Iceni lived in relative peace with Rome. The occupying forces came in about 43 AD, and that's when Rome conquered Britain for the second time. The Iceni had, they'd previously made peace with Rome about 100 years earlier in 55 BC. However, since then, no Roman soldier had been in Britain until 43 AD. They come back.
Huh.
She's likely already married at this time, and she had two daughters already, shortly after the invasion. Life was pretty peaceful for a while in Britain. You know, it was kind of, we won't bother you, you don't bother us.
Right.
The Roman Emperor Claudius, however, was poisoned in 54 AD, and Nero, who is known to history as, like, the worst Roman emperor, succeeded him.
I love Nero. He's misunderstood, and
I know! Actually, there's a great article in one of the National Geographic history magazines, their little supplemental things, that talks about how he wasn't really the worst
one. He was just misunderstood.
Absolutely.
He was an artist and he just wanted to act.
I know.
I wrote an entire 7-page research paper for Chris Woodworth.
About
on Nero?
Nero.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I got a 98 on it.
Good.
From Chris Woodworth.
Good work. However, he was pretty horrible from the point of view
he
of
was.
The people.
I mean, yes. I mean, yeah. He,
so.
He was misunderstood, but he also, I mean, he was not the best.
So Nero, because also Nero was under suspicion of poisoning his uncle Claudius. So to kind of deflect this, he ordered a temple built in honor of Claudius at Camulodunum, which is modern day Colchester. We can just think about it as that. In Britain, he ordered this temple to be built. And the Britons, the native Britons, had to finance the building of the temple and worship there once a year at the altar of the person who invaded them.
It's like Donald Trump saying that Mexico is going to build a wall between the two of us.
You know, actually, when I was reading the story, and there's a great documentary on her as well, it made me think more about the Revolutionary War. And this, there were some similarities.
Absolutely.
So they're building this temple, and the blood's beginning to boil for Boudica and the Iceni at this point. They're not super cool with this.
Of course not.
So a few years later, in 61 AD, Prosodicus dies, leaving in a will the Roman Emperor, Nero, as co-chief of the Iceni along with his two daughters. However, under both Roman rule and Celtic rule, this will had absolutely no legal standing. Everyone was like, hey, you can't really do that. We're going to throw this out. So the Roman procurator, Decinius Catus, arrived at the Iceni court to take command. And Boudica is basically saying, heck no.
Right.
Excuse you. So what he did was he had Boudica flogged and her daughters raped to make them unmarriageable.
God.
So Boudica decided that that meant Roman rule had to end.
Yeah.
It was time for it was time for them to go.
That's a proportionate response.
Exactly. Because also, while these atrocities are being committed to her and to her daughters and to her people, the Romans also destroyed the Druidic center on Mona, an island stronghold. And there are theories that Boudica had druidic training, that she was a druid, and so this would have been just another slap in the face. And other tribes were also angry at Rome at this point and very happy to join her cause.
I could spit right now.
Right? So many of the tribes, they'd actually been secretly stockpiling weapons despite a ban on this from Rome. So before she marched into battle and she's gathered up all these troops and all their stockpiled weapons, Boudica performed some magic by releasing a hair, a rabbit hair, from the folds of her tunic. And when it ran to the side that the Britons believed was good luck, they cheered, and she raised her hand to the heaven and said, "I thank you and trust thee." This is why people think that she had some druidic training.
Oh.
Now she's performed her magic, she's ready to march, and she moved first to fight first in modern-day Colchester, Camulodunum.
Okay.
Where the temple is.
Right.
The army completely overran the town. Her army.
Oh, okay.
Just in two days of fighting, the town fell and it was over. The town was built of timber, which is wood that's harder to burn, apparently.
Right.
But they basically
aged and dry.
Right.
Yeah.
But they chopped up the buildings so much and burned everything so much. They burned the timber and also the clay walls. You can still find pieces of the clay walls fired into pottery as if from a kiln.
Oh my God.
That's how intense the burning was.
Hell hath no fury.
Absolutely none. She next moved to a little town that you might have heard of called Londinium. And she killed everyone that she found there.
Oh, God.
And then I read this fact, but I didn't take note of it, and then I couldn't go back and find it. But I want to share it anyway. Apparently, in, like, the sediment of London today, you can still dig down.
I've heard that, too.
And find, this is when Boudica arrived and burned London to the ground.
They call it the Boudica layer.
Yes, okay, so this...
Yeah. I was watching a documentary about ancient kings of England or something.
Okay.
Or, like, ancient England in general.
Right.
And they were talking, oh, no, you know what it was? It's a documentary about the sewer system.
In London?
In London.
Oh, interesting.
And they talk about how when they were building it, when they were building straight down, it's like 12 feet below where London is now. There's just like a 6-inch layer of chaos.
Yeah, and char. And that's Boudica coming in and burning Londinium to the ground.
And being pissed. I mean, honestly.
Oh, so angry. She hung nobles up naked and made the women appear to be eating themselves by cutting their breasts and then sewing them into their mouths. No joke. This is real. So the Roman forces finally catch up with her as she's burning destruction across the countryside. She had attacked and slaughtered one unit of Roman cavalry already that was coming to try and stop her, just captured them, killed them all. So the Romans now realize we've got a problem on our hands.
They now realized it?
Well, there was one Roman general who heard about her attacking this other cavalry and killing them all and said, I'm going to stay home. He decided, no thanks.
No thanks.
I heard what you did. I see what you did. I'm going to stay in my castle for now. The Romans then hid in a sheltered valley. And the exact location of this battle is something that, it, you know, differs between sources, so it's a little bit debated. The Romans did hide in a sheltered valley and therefore had the tactical advantage, even though Boudica's army, the British army, if we can call it British at this time, was perhaps as many as 20 times as large as the Roman forces. She may have been leading at the head of an army of 230,000 men and women. It's reported that Boudica rode in a chariot with her daughters at the front of this army, announcing that Britons were often engaged in warfare with women in leadership roles and even had women fighting among the men. Now, the theory is...
I haven't said anything in like 4 minutes because my jaw's literally just...
On the floor. So...
God.
The Roman historian who wrote that she, you know, is riding at the front of an army,
sure,
being like, this is totally normal for chicks to be leading 230,000 men into battle.
Right.
They say, okay, that's not likely to have happened because also she would have probably been speaking Celtic and the Romans wouldn't have understood her, but he had her say this to explain to his Roman readers why such a strange and mysterious thing was happening as like this great
warrior. Context clues.
A little bit of exposition, if
you
will.
Yeah. It's almost like the ancient equivalent of Cate Blanchett standing up at the Oscars and going, female movies matter, people. They make money. This is Boudica
exactly.
going, female-led armies can kill every one of you too, people.
Yes. However, sadly, due to the superior training of the Roman army and their tactical advantage from being in this hidden valley, the Boudica's army is coming across an open plain. She was defeated.
Oh, no.
She may have poisoned herself in the aftermath as kind of an honorable suicide.
Uh-huh.
Or she may not have. Again,
sure.
Our two sources differ.
Sure.
Interesting, you brought up Romans just now catching up with her. The Roman general who had decided, I'm not going to be involved. When he found out that she had actually been defeated and Rome had carried the day, he committed suicide and ran onto his sword due to his shame for trying to stop her. It's Dio and Tacitus are two Roman historians, and their versions of her life are similar in most ways, but there are tiny details that differ, like how she died.
Sure.
But it is known that she was given a lavish burial, and after her rebellion failed, and a little bit of time passed, and Rome calmed down, and the Iceni calmed down, the rest of Britain actually became a respected part of the Roman Empire.
Oh.
There are some people who call her the female Braveheart. Don't you just see Charlize Theron playing this in a movie?
I do.
I can see the
paint
scene.
Paint across the face.
Blood and her in a chariot in the middle of, you know, the
who
Welsh countryside.
Who are playing her
Can
daughters?
I be one of them?
Okay, Allison
Please.
On one side. Natalie Portman.
Yes.
With her black swan makeup on.
Yes. And that is Boudica, the new love of my life.
Jesus Christ.
Right?
What a woman.
I know. And in Celtic or British society at the time, however you want to term it, women were in leadership roles. There were women fighting in her army.
Sure.
Although the historians note they weren't very good necessarily, which is part of the reason that a lot of them got killed. But the women still were there and fighting. I know you said you had some quotes from Mary Ellen.
I don't
have any quotes from Boudica because, as I said, everything that we have is put into her mouth by a Roman.
Yeah, so Mary Ellen Pleasant had an unpublished memoir
mm-hmm.
that has a bunch of amazing quotes from it. My favorite of which is in response to a lot of those rumors from
mm-hmm.
the newspapers. And she said, "My cause was the cause for freedom and equality for myself and my people. I'd rather be a corpse than a coward."
I love it.
It reminds
me. I think Boudica said the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Honestly.
Absolutely.
In her own unique way,
yeah.
as Chris Woodworth used to say.
There's an old slave song as
mm-hmm.
well that has a line in it that says, "And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free." That's either an old slave song or an old Jewish Exodus song.
It could be both.
It could be both. That's very true. They could
actually, the Jews were slaves in Egypt.
They were
so
slaves. A lot of the same words, a lot of the same verbiage that comes out of the period of slavery in America echoes pretty closely the language that comes out of Exodus, because they were a very religious people. I mean, the African American community to this day is still a deeply religious people.
Absolutely. The Bitchery of History is proud to partner with Audible.com.
You can go to audibletrial.com/bitchery and download your free audiobook today. Today, I want to recommend most highly Stiff by Mary Roach. It's an amazing book that follows very humorously what happens to bodies when we die, what happens to us when we die, what happens in medical science, what happens in funeral services, what happens in...
Interesting.
Yeah, she goes at one point to this research lab where they have them out so that they can study them for science. She does this amazing bit of writing where she talks about this completely gross and grisly and disgusting bit of science, and you enjoy it. I mean, she's that good of a writer that you enjoy her talking about that kind of stuff.
Very nice. So if you would like to check out Stiff by Mary Roach or any of the other fantastic books on Audible, just go to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
So should we move on to today in herstory?
Yes, indeed. On May 10th, 1840, Elizabeth Cady married Henry Brewster Stanton, becoming Elizabeth Cady Stanton, a huge...
One of the mothers of...
Women's rights.
Suffrage, yeah.
And she omitted the word obey from the marriage ceremony.
Awesome. I think we talked about this before. It's not the first time that that happened, where the word obey was omitted mm-hmm. from the ceremony, but it has precedence because she was such a huge figure.
In women's rights.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then on May 13th, 1995, Alison Hargreaves became the first woman to reach the summit of Mount Everest without the aid of oxygen or Sherpas, the first woman and the second person ever to do so.
Wow.
Yeah. Unfortunately, 3 months later, as part of another expedition to ascend K2, which is the second highest
mm-hmm.
elevation on the Earth, she passed away. She
mm-hmm.
didn't make it all the way up. That happened in August of the same year,
wow.
only 3 months after she became the first woman to scale Everest. R.I.P., you amazing woman.
So our term for the week is... Rape culture.
Rape culture.
It's been on my mind.
Mm-hmm. Any part in particular?
No, not any part in particular. More just in things that I'm seeing. I've been doing a lot of research for different projects recently. This
mm-hmm.
one and a few others that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just a lot of things that pop up in my searches that make me think about it. It was on one of my friend's Facebook statuses this morning, just talking about how she's thinking about going on a date. And it's actually a meme, so it's something, you know, that people
mm-hmm.
can share easily, that she has to consider what is the risk involved.
Mm, yeah.
And she doesn't want to, or he, or any human being in general doesn't want to consider the risk, but you have to. And that's... part
sure.
of it. There's this idea that you have to protect yourself
mm-hmm.
rather than other people just
right.
treating you like a decent human being.
Exactly.
Which is kind of the definition. Do you want to
sure.
share like the actual
I
definition?
I do, yeah. So Marshall College or Marshall
mm-hmm.
University
mm-hmm.
defines rape culture from their Women's Center as an environment in which rape is prevalent and in which sexual violence against women is normalized and excused in the media and popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
Rape culture is perpetuated through the use of misogynistic language, the objectification of women's bodies, and the glamorization of sexual violence, thereby creating a society that disregards women's rights and safety.
Absolutely.
I think one of the most prevalent and maybe one of the easiest examples is to talk about the use of the rape scene in media.
Mm, yes.
And how, you know, there was a big rape scene in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Where, spoiler alert, because it's at the end of the last season.
Right.
And it ignited this huge firestorm over whether or not it was necessary. And rape
Which
culture...
Which is interesting because I don't think it's the only rape scene in Game of Thrones.
No, I don't either. But to be fair,
right.
almost every single rape scene in Game of Thrones has ignited some kind of controversy.
True.
But this one in particular, I remember because the scene kind of played along the line of what is necessary to correctly portray the struggles and the difficulties of what it means to be a woman in
mm-hmm.
that world. And I don't personally think that we shouldn't be showing any depictions of rape on TV.
Right.
Because it's something that we deal with. It's something that exists, and television manufactures consent. The media manufactures
right.
consent. And so by not talking about it, that would almost condone it in a way.
Yeah.
And so this scene in Game of Thrones in particular was difficult because it was more difficult than a lot of the others to say, okay, well, was this necessary? Or
right.
were they just trying to get something which would be the glamorization of sexual violence.
Exactly. And I read an article, I think about a year ago, and I think it was in Entertainment Weekly, that was talking about how a lot of times in the media, especially on television shows,
mm-hmm.
rape is used as a character development tool or to make a women's character
sure.
more interesting.
Sure.
This was speaking about the rape on Downton Abbey and just saying,
oh,
essentially,
yeah.
there's nothing else more interesting you can do to develop her character,
right.
we have to go straight to,
exactly.
oh, well, she's been raped.
Right.
But other examples of rape culture are blaming the victim of rape, saying,
mm-hmm.
you know, you were dressed sexy, you were drunk,
mm-hmm.
it's your fault.
Right. When you're
and not faulting whoever for not holding themselves back.
Exactly.
I know I'm ranting.
It's okay. It's also important to note that rape culture is not just sexual rape. It could also be the rape of the body in other ways. Any unconsenting violation of a human body, as in the most recent Spider-Man movie, when, spoiler alert, Gwen Stacy dies at the end of the movie, there was no reason for that. She dies as a character development for Spider-Man.
That's called Girl in the Fridge.
That is
where
exactly
the
what it's
girlfriend dies to spur the male hero on.
Right. And that is a part of rape culture because it's a physical taking of the body.
Okay.
Body
I see
itself.
That. I
yeah.
see that. Also going on, like, the victim blaming thing, street harassment is part of it too.
Absolutely.
And especially how victims are told that they're overreacting when they call it out. The number of conversations my roommate and I have where we just rant to each other about the horrible things that people have said to us on the street, or the number of times we've been honked at, or the number of times people have yelled out their car windows at us, I would say it's probably twice a week at least, especially
it happens
her.
To me like once every 3 months or so. So and it's always jarring when it happens. So I can only imagine what it's like
every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is something that we talk about a lot too, is that it is so jarring when it happens. You feel like, you know, I'm a strong woman, and I feel like, oh, I'll have a witty answer, I'll snap back.
Exactly.
But you're always so shocked. I think I've talked about this on here before.
We did talk about this, yeah.
The biker and me.
Where you just don't know what to say, so it's not that I
accept
it, it's...
Right, but I was running one day...
Mm-hmm.
And I used to not run with my pepper spray, and now I run with my pepper spray every morning. And I was running one day, there was a bike on the sidewalk. First of all, he should have been on the street, but whatever. And I did the smart thing and like kind of cut through an intersection. I ran kind of through a different way. So that one, I wouldn't be run over by the bike, but also kind of to avoid this person, part of rape culture, me immediately thinking I need to not be around this person. Didn't see them, so I said, okay, I'll cut back to the sidewalk. Then he was behind me again. As he rides past me, slapped me on the butt. And you're so shocked that you don't react.
Yeah. And that
I mean,
is,
I think if he had tried to do more, I would hope to say, I would hope that I would have fought back and I would have like woken up to it.
Yeah.
But just that kind of initial thing, because he just kept right on riding, was just, it blew my mind. And I didn't know.
And
I do have to say,
there are laws against that. I mean, in the state of California, to be charged with assault, all you have to do is put your hand on somebody without their consent.
Yeah.
And that's assault.
Yep.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
If I touched your finger, I'm touching her finger right now. There's this great thing that Louis C.K. talks about in one of his amazing stand-up that's all fantastic.
Right.
Where he talks about a woman getting ready to go on a date and how that thought process, like you talked about, it's, am I going to get home at the end of tonight?
Yeah.
Is this person... this giant person, because most men are bigger than women, is this giant person who I've never met before in my life going to carry me off at the end of the night, you know, without my consent?
Right.
And he says it much more humorously,
right?
Obviously, but it's great. You should look at it. It's on YouTube.
Okay,
I watch it often.
Well, let's post it to the Facebook page.
Right.
Speaking of the Facebook page, that's how you can get in touch with us if you want to share your own thoughts or opinions on anything that we've talked about this week or in any of our other podcasts. We love interacting with our listeners. And that is at facebook.com/umpboh. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, also at umpboh.
For just a few dollars a day, you can support us at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. It's a great way for you to support us and other artists in living our dreams.
Of course. If you can't support us with a few dollars a day, totally understand. Just subscribe to our channel on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podomatic. Leave us a comment letting us know what you think. That helps us in our ratings too. It's almost as good as money, you guys.
Absolutely.
Also, let your friends know about us. Spread the word.
Share the Bitchery page.
Yep.
Follow the Bitchery page. All that fun stuff. The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
And as always,
bitches
get stuff done.